Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour and Editorial Review was heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments right after this. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology to America and to Americans. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. Now, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We covet our neighbor's property, and then we call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes. And then we practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government. And we're not getting away with these crimes either. We're now paying up to 75% of everything that we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies, and then we drive cars owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt, and we now owe, as a nation, nearly $8 trillion of national debt, and we're surety for another $44 trillion of unfunded government obligations. And our financial institutions are leveraged out to about $60 trillion worldwide, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. We live from paycheck to paycheck, and then we've been taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers and our Constitution followed a better way of life than debt. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and ask for my free 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Why don't you call right now? The number's 417-273-4967 to order your free General Law CD package. Again, that number, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email, send an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the birth certificate is not the basis for the creation of credit in this country. And that's because it follows the straw man sight draft proposal, or this new theory floating around the movement, which is totally insane, but it's believed by thousands, if not tens of thousands. It's called the hot new solution in tax protest circles. It's a program that was developed by a fellow named Roger Elvick. Elvick's been to jail at least two or three times that I know of. And this concept, the straw man with sight drafts, the UCC argument in tax protest movements, have been tested a number of times, and the courts are cracking down on it. That, along with, you know, 1,997 other tax protest defenses that have been tested and found wanting. And so Larry Beecraft on his website put up this article called Destroyed Arguments. And so he's proving a negative for us, which is a tough road to hoe. It's difficult to prove a negative. You know, somebody will come to me and say, well, prove to me that the income tax is constitutional. Well, I guess I could do that. But why should I? why should I protect every fool from his folly? What do I get out of it? What's my interest in this program? Now, I can prove that the income tax is constitutional, and so can anybody else that just pays attention to the cases that have already been decided. The courts have declared the income tax to be constitutional many, many times, but that doesn't prove anything to tax protesters. So since you're wasting your time trying to prove something to a tax protester, why waste your time? But Larry took on the burden, and so we're up to the birth certificate, which they're claiming is the basis for the creation of credit in this country. Is your birth certificate the basis for credit creation in the United States? Well, economic tests and a wide variety of other materials plainly demonstrate the manner by which credit or money is created in this country. A bank or a central bank like the Federal Bank, the national system of banking in the United States, extends credit in exchange for the receipt of some note or other financial obligation made by either a private party or government. We call it the Federal Reserve System here in the United States. You'll have something like that in Australia and Canada and New Zealand and so on. A central banking institution, a central clearinghouse for checks and monetary or commercial instruments. Well, at the federal level, the Federal Reserve extends credit to the U.S. Treasury simply by bookkeeping entries made in favor of the United States when the feds buy obligations of the United States. In contrast, a birth certificate is not a note or other debt instrument. And contrary to what Roger Elvick and Ron Nutt and Wally Peterson or idiots like Dave DeRemer may contend, it simply isn't true. Now, simply stated, a birth certificate is not a note, bond, or other financial obligation, and it is not sold to financial institutions, contrary to the blatant lies of the promoters of this argument. Now, in short, the birth certificate is not the foundation for the credit that's used as money in the United States today. Now, why don't you request of these advocates of this scheme, of this argument, that they produce some reliable documentation that birth certificates are the basis of credit in this country rather than the instruments that I have mentioned above. It is simply foolish to rely on the word of Roger Elvick or some other guru. It is even more foolish to believe anything that DeRemer declares. Now, here's flaw number two. The birth certificate cannot be, as a matter of law, a guarantee of debt. You see, a debt is created by a debtor making a promise to pay a creditor a specified amount of money over a specified period of time. Merchandise purchased on credit involves the buyer delivering a promissory note to the seller, wherein he promises to pay a specific periodic amount with interest until the debt is paid. Now, when a borrower obtains a loan, he delivers a promissory note to the lender. A promissory note, by definition, requires the payment of certain specific amounts of funds to the holder of the note. Now, is a birth certificate a promissory note? Read it. It simply cannot be because the party named therein has no obligation to make any payment of anything to any alleged holder thereof, and traffic tickets, indictments, IRS documents, and letters are not commercial instruments. But ignoring for the moment this major fatal flaw in the theory, presume for purposes of argument that a birth certificate is indeed a promissory note. The redemption advocates claim that the straw man is liable to pay some unspecified amount to some unspecified creditor who holds the financial instrument known as a birth certificate. Now, I've been unable to learn from the advocates the name of this creditor, this mysterious creditor. And they further argue that the counterpart of the straw man, you must answer for this debt of the straw man. This is legally impossible. The statute of frauds originates from the common law, and every state today has a general statute of fraud. For example, here in Alabama, we have a statute of frauds found in Alabama Code 892, which states that every special promise to answer for the debt, default, or a miscarriage of another must be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. The same type of requirement appears in our version of the UCC, the Alabama Code 7-2-201, which requires contracts for the sale of goods of more than $500 to be in writing and subscribed by the party liable. Precisely where is your agreement to answer for the debt of the straw man? If such an agreement exists, have you signed that agreement making you legally liable to pay the debt of the straw man? Well, the truth of the matter is that such a signed agreement does not exist, but without your signature to a guarantee making you liable for this debt, you simply cannot be held legally liable. Now, the advocates of this insanity further contend that the international banks, which hold these birth certificates as security for some unknown financial obligation, have a claim against you for your whole life unless you, of course, redeem your straw man by perfecting your claim against him by filing a Form UCC-1 financing statement. Now, can you be legally held responsible for some debt for the rest of your life? Again, our statute of frauds here in Alabama, found in Alabama Code 8-9-2, requires that every agreement which by its terms is not to be performed within 1 year from the making thereof must be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. These redemptionists assert that whenever a child is born and his birth certificate is filled and filed in Washington, D.C., the latter bought by some big bank, the creditor owns you for the rest of your life. Now, we all know that the average life expectancy of a baby is longer than a single year. So just where is this agreement signed by you, apparently on the day you were born, which cannot by its very terms be performed within a single year? And have you ever signed such an agreement? Well, the truth of the matter is that every aspect of this redemption theory flies in the face of the statute of frauds. Now, there's a third flaw. Our bodies and our labor are not articles of commerce. Now, the redemption process advocates contend that by way of our birth certificates, we have pledged our bodies and labor of our lifetimes to those creditors who hold these birth certificates. In essence, our labor is commerce according to this theory. The purchase of these birth certificates is allegedly performed in Washington, D.C. However, at this place where federal law clearly applies, federal law declares, by way of 15 U.S.C. Section 17, that the labor of a human being is not a commodity or article of commerce. Now, does this redemption argument not plainly conflict with federal law? Flaw number four. The 1935 Social Security Act did not create an account for everyone born in this country in the amount of approximately $630,000. In review of the material that I have provided regarding this argument, it is plainly alleged that whenever anyone is born in this country, a sum of $630,000 is deposited into some account at the U.S. Treasury or the Social Security Administration, and that this account was created by the 1935 Social Security Act. This contention is totally false, as may be seen simply by reading the act, which is posted in the Social Security Administration website. And flaw number five. The above-named account is not the Treasury direct account. Neither the original Social Security Act nor any amendment to that act created an account known as the Treasury direct account. However, there is such an account established by the Treasury for those who routinely purchase U.S. notes and bonds. A description of this account may be found in 31 CFR Part 357 and specifically 31 CFR 357.20. Those who assert that everyone has such an account know nothing about these types of accounts, and there is no public side and private side for these accounts. Flaw number 6. You cannot write site drafts on the Treasury of the United States by way of this non-existent account. And if you send any such site drafts to anyone, you will be prosecuted for violations of 18 U.S.C. Section 514, which provides as follows. In Section 514, fictitious obligations. It says, whoever with the intent to defraud, one, draws, prints, processes, produces, publishes, or otherwise makes or attempts or causes the same within the United States, or two, passes, utters, presents, offers, brokers, issues, sells, or attempts, or causes the same, or with like intent passes within the United States, or three, utilizes interstate or foreign commerce, including the use of the mails or wire, radio, or other electronic communication, to transmit, transport, ship, move, transfer, or attempts, or causes the same, to, from, or through the United States, any false or fictitious instrument, document, or other item appearing, representing, purporting, or contriving through scheme or artifice to be an actual security or other financial instrument issued under the authority of the United States, a foreign government, a state, or other political subdivision of the United States, or an organization shall be guilty of a Class B felony. Now, for purposes of this section, any term used in this section that is defined in Section 513C has the same meaning given such term in Section 513C. And C, the United States Secret Service, in addition to any other agency having such authority, shall have authority to investigate offenses under this section. Violations of this statute provide for a maximum period of 25 years imprisonment. Now, a friend of mine from Kuski, Idaho, attended a meeting where Jack Smith of Right Way Law spoke regarding this new redemption process. During a break at this meeting, my friend asked Smith to provide specific authority and documentation demonstrating that this was a bona fide agreement. Smith admitted that this new argument was 100% theory. This redemption process is perhaps one of the craziest legal theories that I have ever seen arise within this patriot movement. And yet people blindly accept this argument without question and without any investigation. I want to pause here and make a little editorial comment myself, because remember I mentioned last time that I had four or five students come down here from Cleveland, Ohio, and they were passing on these site drafts. Now, in their case, they actually had the secret code number of the Department of Transportation. And with that code number, you could practically write out a check or an instrument on a 3x5 card in longhand with that number on there and go out anywhere and buy a new Ford Explorer, as one of these guys had done, paid the mortgage off on his house. Now, the actual pieces of paper that they were printing up came out of their computers. So they'd sit down at their computers and they would write up an instrument. And it was a peculiar looking instrument to me. I'd never seen one before. Wasn't a check. Wasn't a warrant. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a site draft or some kind of an instrument. And boy, did they look good. And all of them told me that when they delivered these site drafts or these checks or these warrants, whatever it was, they would clear the bank. And as one guy said, he took it down to the Ford dealer to buy the Ford Explorer, presented it. They went out of the office, came back, and said, boy, this is a wonderful deal. And they accepted it and gave him his new car, and he drove away. In fact, he drove it down here to school. And he said to me, he said, if there's something wrong with this, then why did they sell me the car? Well, you know, when a paper hanger, that's what they call a fictitious check writer in the underworld here. They call them paper hangers. Goes out and writes a check. It looks good. And it's done for the purpose of deceiving the fellow who receives it. Now, if you can go in here and deceive somebody, does that make it honest or legal or lawful? If somebody is deceived by some contrivance that you come up with? It reminds me of a story I got to share with you here. I was in jail one time in the cell block H in the Ada County Jail. And if that's shocking to some of you, I'll sit back and relax. I'm a civil rights investigator, and from time to time I get locked up in jail testing some legal theory, and I've done this for many, many years, and I've been there many, many times. But while I was in jail, there was an Englishman in there, and I sat down to interview this Englishman, as is my habit. I interview people in jail. And this fella had been arrested 3 times in his career for paper hanging, for writing fictitious or bogus checks. And his latest scheme was where he would set up shop, and he came to Boise, Idaho. Now, this guy was from England. He'd been to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and now he'd found his way to this little town, the state capital of Idaho, Boise, Idaho. Population about, at that time, probably 110,000 or 120,000 people. And he was papering the town with checks. And here was his scheme. He opened up about 10 checking accounts in neighboring states like Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Missoula, Montana, and Casper, Wyoming, and Salt Lake City, Utah, and so on. And of course, an account there in Boise, Idaho. So he writes checks. He took $30,000 of his own money and deposited that money in these 4 or 5 surrounding states and started writing checks to his company in Boise, Idaho. So he would write these checks, let's say on the bank in Salt Lake City, and that check would arrive at the ABC Import Export Company in Boise, Idaho, and he would deposit that in his bank in Boise. Then he would turn around and write a check and take out the cash, and then he would convert the cash to another account and then send that check back to Salt Lake City. And what he did was he created a checking account history or record of $1 million or more going through this Boise account. I mean, I don't know how much, maybe $2, $3, $5 million. You know, you're writing a check on your Salt Lake City account for $5,000, and you're doing this every day, every day, every day, every day. There are these checks coming into this account. So the banker down there says, geez, look at the money that goes through this account. And so the banker says, well, God, this guy's making a lot of money. So he comes into the banker and he says, gosh, I've got this cashier's check that's coming in from London. And it's $30,000, and I need you to cash that for me. Could you do that? And the banker says, well, sure. The check comes in, $30,000 from London or some foreign country, and it's a good check. That's this guy's own money. I mean, it's good. And he cashes it, and he walks out of the bank with the cash. And this goes on for quite a long time. This guy's cashing $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 cashier's check. Now, all of this money is the same $30,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 that he's recycling through all of these accounts. And there's all this activity going on, see? Gosh, it just really looks great. Well, here comes time to score. These checks are getting progressively larger and larger. It's $30,000, $50,000, $100,000, and so on. And pretty soon he goes to his banker and he says, now, next Wednesday I'm going to receive a check for $433,666 from Manchester, England, and I need to cash that check. And the banker says, no problem, no problem. And that's because every check that's gone through here so far has been good. There's no fictitious or fraudulent checks. So he goes in on Friday and brings in this check, and sure enough, it comes from Manchester. This banker now the paper hanger's banker. He's been doing this for a year. Here comes the score. They're going to score on the bank now. This check isn't any good. This is a check that this guy made up. he printed this check himself. And he cashes the check. Now, over the weekend, he starts making wire transfers. He starts writing checks and cashing them. And by the following Monday, now, he has cleaned out this $433,000 account here at the bank in Boise. The bank is left here holding this piece of paper, and he walks out with his $400,000. Now, this is a big score. This guy is a big-time check writer. And that's what's going on here with this redemption. Somebody is a check writer and has gone out here and gotten hold of these secret bank account numbers, these code numbers. Because see, old Frank, my broker up in Boise, is an ex-banker. And when I sent that to him, I said, Frank, would you cash that check? And he said, well, certainly I'd cash that check. I'm going to check the code. And if the code is current, and if the code is good for the Department of Transportation, anybody that walks in with a piece of paper with that code on it, the bank is going to cash it. And that's what these guys are dealing with. So when somebody comes up to you with one of these schemes, and they say, gee, you can pay off your mortgage, it's called unjust enrichment. Unjust enrichment. If you didn't work for it, if you didn't create it, if you didn't make it, if it's not yours, it's unjust enrichment. And any time you're dealing in unjust enrichment, you're dealing in some kind of a theft, some kind of a crime. It's just where reality is. The fact that the check clears, the fact that you don't understand how the process works is irrelevant and immaterial. And I pointed this out. The FBI comes and knocks on this guy's door. He called me here at the school, and he said, the FBI was here. And one of the guys called me, and he said that the FBI had come, and he was really incensed. He says, you know, I've been cashing these checks now for over a year, and all of these checks are good, and all of these checks clear. This guy had never earned a dime of this money that he was writing these checks and cashing for. And he's incensed because the FBI came and knocked on his door and said, well, why are you writing these checks? Where'd you get this money? And he thought, you know, I got Fourth Amendment rights here. You know, I got a right to be personal and private. I don't know, guys. You know, just common sense, you know, ought to tell you a little better than that. But maybe greed clouds our reason, logic, and common sense. Maybe that's what doesn't. Now, you can't write site drafts on the Treasury of the United States by way of this non-existent account. That's the bottom line. And violations of this statute provide for a maximum 25 years imprisonment. Now, I don't think that judges and courts and juries want to take a floor layer or a real estate broker who's been caught up in this kind of activity, criminal activity, and throw them in jail for 25 years. You know, all these guys are going to end up being first-time offenders. I mean, these guys aren't professional check writers like this Englishman that I just told you about. That Englishman, now, he just makes his living stealing. I mean, the guy was he was in his 50s. That's 20 years ago. A guy in his 50s made his living all of his life stealing from people, stealing from banks. He's graduated. He's up in the big leagues now. He's writing cashier's checks. Listen, even bankers can be lied to, cheated, defrauded. Don't think that if you've been lied to, cheated, and defrauded, that it's something peculiar to you because you're lacking in experience or you're dumb. I mean, they get to the biggest and the best of us. I've been lied to and deceived and cheated many times, and I thought I was a pretty astute businessman. There's always somebody that comes along with some new wrinkle. Now, if you go back and you take a look, God told you don't use unjust weights and balances. You know, if we practiced gold and silver, hard money, none of this would be possible. If we followed those biblical statutes, there wouldn't be any checks. There wouldn't be any insurance policies. You wouldn't have any commercial paper at all, period, none, zero. When you come here to buy my cow, you leave the gold and walk off with my cow. cash and carry. But, you know, we decided God had made a mistake, and so we had to fix that. So we've created economies, national economies, world economy. We've got commercial paper and stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments, and we've got a world on the knife's edge of economic collapse. And it's coming. Just get ready for it. As the old saying says, bend over and get the Vaseline. All right, let's take a quick break here for a second, and we'll give you a message, and we'll be right back with more on Destroyed Arguments here by Larry Beecraft right after this. Now, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and social security programs. Income tax and social security programs are incompatible with our traditional American values. And that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology to our traditional American values. That's because our traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. You know, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We've been taught to covet our neighbor's property and then call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes and checks and other commercial paper. And then we're taught to practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government. And we're not getting away with these crimes. There's a penalty to pay, and that's because we're now paying up to 75% of everything that you and I create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged houses owned by savings and loan companies. We don't own those houses free and clear. We drive cars owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. We don't own our cars free and clear. The average family of four in the United States of America has a $70,000 consumer debt. We're not free and clear. Then as a nation, we owe about $8 trillion. We just raised that debt limit the other day. We owe $8 trillion. We're surety for another $44 trillion of unfunded government obligations for Social Security and veterans benefits, and on the list goes. You know, our financial institutions are also leveraged out to over $60 trillion worldwide. They're called derivatives. Our Social Security retirement system's a chain letter Ponzi scheme. And it's bankrupt. Again. For the third time. And we live from paycheck to paycheck. And we call all of this prosperity. Well, you know, God gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers at Article 1, Section 10 in our federal constitution followed that better way. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life than debt and commercial paper, why don't you call and ask for my free 4-hour general law compact disc package? Just call and say, hey, what's that free thingy that you're giving away? Can I have one of those? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to your website and just go to georgegordon.org. Go to your computer and then go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto that email machine when you get to the website and then send an email request. Be sure to put in your mailing address because this goes out by snail mail. I'm going to send it to you. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of redemption, straw men, and the crazy arguments that go along with them. I don't think that people are crazy. These students that came here, they're not crazy. They're just deceived. That's what the bottom line is. Patriots out there mean well. They're sincere. They're honest people, by and large, out here working to make a living. And somebody comes along and says, hey, the government's lying to you and stealing from you. They're telling you the truth when they tell you that. Yeah, your government lies to you and steals from you all the time. It's been going on for years. So what else is new? And then they get excited and they get incensed and they say, well, that's not right that they're stealing from me. And then the pitch man, he says, well, you need to buy this or that $75 packet, or you need to stop filing your income tax or this or that. And Boy, that appeals to a lot of people. That appeals. The problem with that is that when you have a legal liability, a legal obligation, then you have a duty to perform. It's kind of like having a military obligation. I remember when I was a youngster, you know, we had to go down and register for the draft. Well, when you go down and register for the draft, you're a citizen of the United States, you get a registration card in your back pocket. You've got a duty, and if you get called up in the draft, then you have a duty to go off and serve. Now, if you don't want to join the Army, and you don't want to go off and serve, and you don't want to be drafted into the Army, did you know there's a legal methodology for exemption from military service? It's called conscientious objector status. And it's spelled out in the law. And there's a lot of people that take advantage of that. It's not available to you Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. That's because if you're a Catholic, Protestant, or a Jew, you belong to a religious organization that is not opposed to conscientious objector status. But there are a lot of groups out there that are conscientious objectors. And if you happen to be one of those, there is an exemption written under the law, and it's an exemption written for you. And the people that are in the know take advantage of that. So I remember during the Vietnam War, people were running off to Canada, and they were just, you know, beside themselves, with like George Bush, how can I get out of going to Vietnam? So he joined the National Guard. He had some political pull. His daddy was a representative in Congress. So George Bush got an appointment or got a commission for the Texas Air National Guard, which stayed here in the United States, never went to Vietnam. He fulfilled his military service, or at least that's what's purported to be, and he did that without violating the law. Special pull. Now, if you're one of these people that don't have that kind of special pull, and you're saying to yourself, "Well, that's not right. That's not fair. That's not honest. That's true," but since when are politics and law fair and honest? I mean, just take a look around you. You know that's not true, that we don't have fairness, not everywhere. You might find a little fairness and a little honor once in a while, but as a general rule, that isn't the case. And then Bill Clinton, he didn't go to Vietnam. He came up during that Vietnam era, and he stayed out of the draft. I think he went to England and stayed in school or something like that. As long as you're in school, there's deferments and there's methodologies for doing this legally. And then, of course, there were the guys that just plain said, "Hell no, I won't go." Some of those people got caught up and prosecuted and put in prison. If you'll remember the fighter Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, he claimed that he was a conscientious objector, and of course, he's a pretty high-profile guy. They actually prosecuted him. Final conclusion was that, yeah, he was a Muslim. He was a conscientious objector. He qualified for a conscientious objector status, and he didn't go. They prosecuted him, but they couldn't. Well, I think they did convict him, but it was overturned on appeal. Now, here's the bottom line to this. There's a legal, lawful methodology for doing things, and you have to practice the law. The trick in law is this. You practice all the laws of the United States. You practice all the laws of your state. You practice all the laws of God, and you do them all at the same time. And you can get all these benefits. You can get conscientious objector status. You can make money without stealing. You don't have to steal to make a living. You don't have to steal to make or to create wealth. It isn't necessary. Most people don't know how to do that, but if you did know how, if you could learn how, you too could be a conscientious objector. You don't need to evade the draft. There's a methodology, a legal methodology for staying out of the service. I remember when I was a kid, I was going to catechism. I was put in a Lutheran school is what happened. Wasn't my choice, but I was sent off to this Lutheran day school. And in this school, they had multiple grades. Well, the kids that were in the upper grades were facing the draft back in the Korean War. And they didn't want to go into the service. And so Lutherans are not conscientious objectors, and they're not exempt from the military. But they wanted to be. And so here was the preacher trying to advise these high school students how to stay out of the army. It was a classic case of that biblical expression that says, when the blind lead the blind, they both fall in the ditch. And they, of course, these guys are all crossways with the law. They can't comply with Seeger versus U.S. They can't comply with the exemptions for the Amish or Christian Scientists or other groups, you know, that are exempted from the draft, but they wanted to be. And they were crosswise with the Missouri Synod. That was another fallacy or another problem. And this preacher, this pastor here, was leading these guys, these high school seniors, down the primrose path to prison, along with himself. Now, fortunately, for everybody concerned, when it was all said and done, they didn't prosecute the preacher, and they didn't prosecute the students, and they went down and they registered for the draft like the law requires, and I suppose some of them got drafted, and some of them probably went over to Korea, and some of them probably even got killed, and that's the breaks of the game. But they didn't go to prison. You know, they ironed the thing out. Now, in many cases, like you're looking at here with this redemption program here, you're starting to see more and more prosecutions. You're starting to see more and more people going to jail. Just innocent people who got caught up in these kinds of tax protest schemes. And that's all they are, just tax protest schemes. You need to watch out for that. You need to be alert to that. You need to be aware of it. The income tax is lawful. It's constitutional. If you don't want to pay the income tax, stop having income. There was life before income, and there will be life after income. The income tax is just a temporary aberration that's here today, and at some point in the future, it'll collapse of its own weight and it'll disappear. It's just the way life is. Meanwhile, it's here today, and you've got to deal with it. Now let's take a look at these three-judge courts argument. Long ago, in the case of Marbury versus Madison, cited at 5 U.S. 137 back in 1803, the Supreme Court considered the question of whether the federal judiciary could decide that a law was unconstitutional, and of course the court concluded that it and the lower courts did in fact have such power. Now, ever since 1803, both state and federal courts, either at the original trial, the trial court level, or on appeal, have exercised this judicial power to find state and federal laws unconstitutional. There are lots of laws that are unconstitutional, and they have been declared to be unconstitutional. That doesn't mean that they're taken off the books. For instance, back in 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that vagrancy was unconstitutional. Last year, 274,000 Americans were prosecuted and convicted for vagrancy. How can that be? If it was declared unconstitutional, wasn't it illegal? Well, the courts have a solution to that. They said, look, the burden is for you to know and to decide whether or not a law is constitutional or unconstitutional. You're supposed to know that. I'm not quite sure how the court rationalizes that and comes to the conclusion that Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife could research that out and figure that out and find that out. Typically only a lawyer could do that, but, you know, we teach that here. It's called legal research, and you can find out. But, you know, just be practical. The average guy doesn't know that. And there are lots of laws like that that have been declared unconstitutional, but they're still on the books, and they still generate a lot of revenue for state and local governments that fine people. And they're still powerful tools in the hands of the police and other law enforcement agencies that use these laws that are actually not laws. They're unconstitutional processes. And the courts have said, well, if you believe in it and you want to practice it, you certainly have the right to do that. So if you want to walk into court and declare, I want to plead guilty to vagrancy, well, you can do that. So if some municipality has vagrancy on the books and they charge you with vagrancy and you walk in and plead guilty to vagrancy, that's fine. Now, if you walk in and plead not guilty, we'll have a trial. And if the jury or the judge and you put on this defense, and if you're found guilty, and if you don't appeal, well, then we'll carry out that sentence and we'll punish you accordingly. Isn't that just special? Now, of course, if you know that this law is unconstitutional and you don't want to plead into this fiction of law and you want to defend it, you want to appeal, and you tell everybody plainly, this law is unconstitutional and I'm not going to plead into this fiction of law and I'm not going to participate in this, and file a motion to dismiss, they'll dismiss you out. Isn't that just real special? So that's why it's important for you to know what the law is, or at least, you know, be smart enough to know how to research the law out. Let me tell you a quick story here. Years ago, I was operating a company in Boise, Idaho called Atlantis Manufacturing Company, 412 South 9th Street. You people in Boise can drive by the famous Atlantis company. And the EPA came in and they charged our company, the Atlantis Manufacturing Company, with polluting the air. So my partner at that time, Peter, and old Pete, he said, well, we'll go to Bickle and Bickle will get us, he'll get us a way out of this and we'll plea bargain out of this. And so our lawyer, the company lawyer, did just that. He negotiated a plea bargain arrangement. And we were supposed to plead guilty to polluting the air and pay a $300 fine. Sounds easy enough, doesn't it? I mean, that's what the big corporations do. They just plead guilty and pay a fine and go about their business and steal more billions of dollars from the general public. That's what Wall Street does. They go out and steal $7 trillion from the American public, and I think they paid $100 billion worth of fines. They paid 1/70th of the amount they stole in fines to the government. Well, that just adds insult to injury, doesn't it? Here are the thieves, the Wall Street bankers, stealing 7,000 billion dollars from us, and they have to pay $100 billion of it back. They don't pay it to us, the guys they stole it from, they pay it to the government. So you got the government profiting off of the theft, and you got the Wall Street bankers profiting off of the theft, and you and I are the losers. And we call that justice here in America, for all you Canadians and Australians out there. That's what we call justice in this country. So when the Wall Street market collapsed, you know, back in 2000, for the next 3 years, the bankers, they raked in that $7 trillion that we all lost on the stock market. And then they found out that it was a big hoax and there was a lot of fraud going on. This guy, Elliot Spitzer, you know, the Attorney General of New York, he came in there and he won some cases against the Wall Street bankers, but they paid back, you know, pennies on the dollar of what they stole. Well, anyway, here comes the United States government. In this case, it was the government of Idaho against the Atlantis Company. And they worked out this deal. Well, I wasn't too happy with this deal, so I went out and I talked to an old lawyer up there. He's still there. His name is Ben Rice. Old Ben Rice, the Mormon lawyer, I called him. And I went out to his office. Some guy steered me on to him. And so, as Jerry Spence says, you know, the best lawyers in America are tucked away in little inauspicious places. Well, this is one of those lawyers, and he was tucked away in a little town called Cuna, K-U-N-A, Cuna, Idaho. Ben Rice, the Mormon lawyer, walked into his office and told him what was going on. He kind of smiled knowingly, and he said, oh, okay, I hear you. I told him the story. I said, they charged us with, here's the background. OSHA came in, and they said, you got to put in a new spray booth. So we put in a new spray booth, spent $8,000 doing it, and then the EPA comes in and says, no, that spray booth is all wrong. That spray booth has to be ripped out, and you got to put it into our standards. And I said, hell, that ain't right. Something wrong with this. And this old Mormon lawyer, he said, yeah, that's the way the game's played, all right. And I said, well, what can we do about that? He said, well, do you want to go to trial and win? I said, yeah. He said, that's $4,000. And I said, well, I got a plea bargain arrangement made, and we can plead guilty and pay $300. He said, that's the way the game's played. They bring a bogus charge against you. And then they say, well, if you want to plead guilty to this bogus charge, the fine's $300. If you want to defend it, you got to go hire a lawyer because you can't do it yourself and the price is $4,000. How's that for a plan? That's justice in America. Boy, I was really ticked off. I went back and I told my partners and I told the board of directors and And they said, come on, you know, be intelligent, Gordon. We got a 300. This is business. Business. Business is business. We're not here to be moralists. We don't care about right and wrong, good and bad. We just care about making money. We'll pay the $300 fine, and we'll just charge it off as a cost of doing business. Well, I was kind of moved by morality, and so I went out to Rice, and I said, well, now, can you guarantee that you'll win? And he said, yeah, I could do that. So here was the deal. It's $4,000 to win, nothing to lose, and if he wins the case, I buy lunch, and if he loses the case, he buys lunch. So I came back and made the announcement, and my partner, Peter, he said, if you do this, I will turn state's evidence and testify against you. Do you hear that? My partner. My business associate. You go out there and defend right and wrong, and if you won't go in and plead guilty to something that you didn't do for the sake of money, for the sake of profit, for the sake of business, I will turn state's evidence and go in and testify for you. Now, we'll need this to say, my old buddy Peter and I have not been very good buddies from that day forward. And it's just the way life is, isn't it? So, Pete went in on Wednesday, pled guilty, paid the $300 fine. And George Gordon pled not guilty and went in on Friday. And the government came in, and they presented a whale of a good case. I mean, they really did their homework. They had a van parked down the railroad tracks from our plant, and they were sampling the air. And when they did that, they could come in and tell you that that was Dutch Boy Batch 2247, which was produced on the 13th day of June 1979, or whatever the date was. I mean, they could tell you the brand. They could tell you the batch number. Boy, the government is really spectacular. I don't know what that cost. They had two or three guys in there, witnesses. I imagine they were getting paid pretty good. They had a government van, a government equipment, one thing and another. I mean, these guys spent thousands and thousands of dollars to collect this $300 fine to get this conviction. Of course, didn't make any difference. The government enforcing the laws. If it costs $1 million to enforce the law and to get a $300 fine, what's the problem? There's no end of money from you taxpayers out there, is there? And they did. And they came in, they proved their case. They proved that we were polluting the air. Well, old Ben got up, and he moved to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case, cited Idaho Code 19-407. The judge went back and read it, and came back out, and she said, case dismissed. And we all left the courthouse. That's all he did. He moved to dismiss. And they dismissed. Well, naturally, I got to pay Ben $4,000 to win. I got to buy lunch, and we're having lunch. And I said, well, what was the winning argument? He said, well, here's what happened. The government took the regulations from California and applied them here in Idaho. You see, Idaho Code 19-407 that they charged you under is reserved. Our legislature here in Idaho has not passed any air quality standards as of 1980. So they were enforcing the California law in Idaho illegally. And they snookered my partner, and he pled guilty, paid a $300 fine. It was totally illegal. Do government officials do that? Every day. Make money doing that. Lots of it. Justifies their existence. And that's just one of their neat little tricks. Well then, wouldn't you say then that Peter could come back to court at some future date and say, look, I pled guilty to a crime that doesn't exist. There's no law in Idaho that regulates air quality. Not yet. They probably do today, 30 years later, you know, or 20 years later, but they didn't then. The answer is no. He went in and pled guilty of his own free will. He made a contract with the state. He said, I'm a bad boy, and I feel real bad about it, and I want to pay a fine, and I want to go on probation. Now, he was on $300 fine and 6 months probation, pled guilty to a law that didn't exist. Can you do that in America? Every day. Goes on every day. Now, going back here to this three-judge court's argument here, back in Marbury versus Madison over here, the determination as to whether or not a law is constitutional or unconstitutional is decided by the courts. And just because laws have been declared to be unconstitutional does not mean that they're taken off the books and that they're abolished and done away with. Another example was Brown versus Texas. That law down in Texas said you had to identify yourself to a police officer. So the court said in Brown v. Texas in 1979, no, you don't. Texas still has that law on the books. In fact, 24 states around the country have that law on the books. In fact, it was just distinguished this year in a Supreme Court case out in Nevada. And it was litigated out in California. A guy by the name of Lawson versus Colander, 1985. So here's a law that's unconstitutional as it's applied to people in certain circumstances. The law itself isn't unconstitutional, but the way the law is applied to people, and that's the way unconstitutionality comes up. The law is either unconstitutional on its face, it's illegal and unlawful on its face, like can you make blacks ride the back of the bus? The answer is no. Or it's illegal and unlawful, it's unconstitutional as it's applied to this person in this circumstance. And that's where Brown v. Texas comes in. Here's the other side of the coin. Does California take that law off the books? Does Texas take that law off the books? No. No, they leave it on the books. It produces millions of dollars a year in revenue to you people that walk in there and plead guilty to those, just like my old buddy Peter. If you want to walk in and plead guilty to a unconstitutional law, you can do that. Does that go on in America? Every day. Every day. It's why I opened a law school. I said, you know, I think Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife need to be informed of this. Larry Beecraft's of the same opinion. That's why I put this program on his website. He says, you know, these arguments that these patriots over here, these patriot groups are advancing, are bogus arguments. So you got the government over here screwing you, blueing you, and tattooing you, number one, and then you got these patriot suckers over here screwing you, blueing you, and tattooing you at the same time. It's like you got the pilot fish and the sharks, and they're both fleecing you. That's his point, and that's mine. We'll be back tomorrow night with the conclusion. We'll take a look at this three-judge court's argument, and we'll conclude this with the balance of the arguments next time. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.